me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Claudia Rowe has spent over 30 years shining light on the often overlooked places where children and government systems collide. Originally from New York City and now rooted in Seattle, she's made a career out of listening deeply and writing with compassion and clarity. Her investigative reporting on racially biased school discipline at the Seattle Times didn't just spark conversation, it helped change education laws in Washington State. Her powerful work exploring the lives of Latino youth involved in gangs earned her a Pulitzer Prize nomination. Beyond the newsroom, Claudia's voice has reached national audiences through the New York Times, Mother Jones, and Amazon Original Stories. Her 2018 memoir, The Spider and the Fly, a haunting true crime narrative, won the Washington State Book Award and showcased her uniquely ability to blend storytelling with psychological insight. Today, as a member of the editorial board at the Seattle Times, Claudia focuses her lens on some of the most vulnerable members of society, foster youth, kids in the justice system, and students navigating a complex education system. Her latest book, Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care, continues her commitment to give voice to those that are often left unheard. Claudia, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a fantastic intro.
Let's just say Seattle's in the house. So before we get started, just tell us a little bit, how did you get involved in this work? Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk.
Sure. I'm really interested in why people make the decisions they do. I'm really interested in motivation and what drives people. I think I have been interested in that since I was a little kid. So when I was, getting out of college and what was I going to do with my life, I knew it was going to be something with writing. How was I going to support myself as a writer? I had strong interest in a number of social issues. And so, won't surprise anyone to know, if you want to write and you care about social issues, you're going to head toward journalism. So that is what I did. It was only later as a journalist, but pretty soon in my career, that I began to understand the power that, you can actually make change. You can see change happen. It's frankly quite shocking what one story can do if it hits the right person at the right moment. So once I found that I could actually impact people through journalism, I just doubled down, right? I just got deeper and deeper into it. But that original question, why do people do the things they do? What is driving them? Pretty much has shaped my career. And, I was initially focusing that question on crime, right? What is driving a person who commits crimes? Because everybody has, a reason for what they're doing. Even if we don't understand it, the person has a logic, an idea in their mind, a thing they're driving them, an anger, a ghost from the past, a feeling for a need for revenge, whatever it might be. But we don't know what that is. We just see the action. So when I was sort of a really young reporter, an editor said to me, "You want to know why people do the things they do? You want to know? Why don't you look in the schools? Why don't you start looking at public schools? They're shaping kids, they're formative experiences." And I was like, no, I don't want to look at the schools. At the time, this was the early 90s, education reporting was not what it is today. And it was definitely seen as sort of a you know, shunt the lady reporters off into the schools because it's about little kids. It was this idea like, oh, it's sweet and it's kids and it's bake sales. It's not. And it wasn't then. And it never was. But, you know, he said, no, no, you really need to be looking at the schools. And once I did, he was totally right. And I saw that when you look at schools, you're looking at a lot more than, you know, sweet little kids. You're looking at labor, you're looking at money, you're looking at brain science. And, you know, at the time I was covering public schools in the Bronx in New York, and it won't surprise anyone that I was also covering crime. There was a lot of crime in schools of all kinds, right? Mm-hmm. All kinds of crime. So that sort of led to juvenile justice and reporting on juvenile justice. And then that led to child welfare. And the intersection between juvenile justice and child welfare was not something that, even though I was sort of navigating these circles, I did not appreciate the extreme overlap until much, much later. But now looking back, I see that it was there from the beginning.
Amazing stuff. Now we're talking about foster care. How did you get involved with this? And just help us understand what is wrong with the system.
Okay. So after a number of years in New York, I moved across the country, landed in Seattle, started writing about social issues at Seattle had two newspapers. I started working for one of them. And it was just sort of a standard part of my beat. I wasn't hunting it down or anything like that. But foster care, as most people understand it, and it's shocking how little in the mainstream it is. So what most people know is very young children, babies, really young children, born to addicted moms, and the hospitals whisk the kids away and they're born addicted, and we like give them to caring adults who will raise them into, you know, shining successful lives. That is what sort of the popular idea about foster care is. Like, we're going to rescue kids and they're going to be great, and we're going to send them off into the world to have these productive, normal adult lives. That, of course, is not so true. However, covering foster care typically does focus on really young kids. And it wasn't until much later that I began to look at older youth. And, you know, in like the early 2000s, maybe 2005, 6, in the early 2000s, studies began to come out looking at sort of the adult outcomes of kids who had grown up in foster care. And that is when the light bulb first went on for me, when I saw, like, wow, the incredible numbers of kids who leave foster care and almost immediately are homeless, or kids who are locked up while they're still foster kids and they're in juvie, or they age out of foster care at 18 with spotty educations at best because they've moved around through many foster homes. You don't usually stay in one over a long period of time unless you're going to be adopted. But if you're not adopted, you're going to move from home to home, and you might be moving from school district to school district. So, you know, roughly 50% of foster youth drop out of high school before ever getting a diploma. That's national number. So that is why when kids age out at 18, you're like, you're 18, now you're a grown up, right? Like, what 18-year-old is really a full adult? But the law says you're 18, we now cut off government support to your foster parent. So foster parents are literally like, okay, here you go, good luck to you, and sort of with a wave and a goodbye at the door. When I was first writing about this in like 2005 or 6, my editor said, no, that's gotta be an exaggeration. We're not gonna, you know, a kid had told me that, oh yeah, I left with my stuff in a garbage bag and my foster parent waved at the door. My editor said, that's gotta be hyperbole. That's exaggerated. No kids are just sent off into the wilderness with a garbage bag of clothes. But it is in fact true. It is sort of normal. So what's wrong with foster care? in a nutshell, it does not set kids up for solid, stable, productive adult lives. There are many kids who have aged out of foster care and gone on to be successful, but that's in spite of foster care. They're not the norm. Most kids who are so-called alumni of the system have poor educations, and more importantly, have never been able to really bond in a stable, ongoing way with any kind of caring adult, because they move from home to home. Their social workers who are assigned to them as caseworkers change all the time on a dime with no warning, no handoff. So there's really no stability. And you might say, oh, that must be hard, or that's too bad. Yes, it is. It's more than that. It actually does. It makes chemical changes in your brain. It actually has a neurological effect. And this is not my, you know, crazy theory. The National Academies of Science government reports have shown this, have proven this, and are saying, yes, foster care is inherently damaging, even though there's no abusive person. It's the system itself that is an inherently damaging experience. So that's what's wrong with foster care.
Sad enough that I've heard this before, and in my time in New York, I had to see this firsthand, and it is sad. It's almost as if you don't wish your birthday to come, and these kids are coming into a place where once I hit that number, I'm cooked, to use their words.
That's exactly right. Turning 18 is a really stressful experience for many, many foster youth.
I want to touch base a little bit about the foster care to prison pipeline. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So as I mentioned, in the early 2000s, I began sort of looking at older foster youth. There started to be more and more reports about this. And I had this inkling about, I had this sense of the crossover between foster care and lockup in juvenile detention. And I remember clearly asking a caseworker in the system, is there any data about that? I'm starting to hear about it a lot, but nobody's really talking about it. And she said, yeah, maybe this guy, Joseph Doyle. And it was sort of like this brushed off thing. Well, Joseph Doyle is an economist at MIT. He's no minor deal. Joseph Doyle is an economist at MIT who did a study in 2006 and in 2008 that showed that foster kids were three times more likely to end up incarcerated than other kids in difficult situations. I mean, you can't exactly prove, like, this kid, if he didn't go, you know, into foster care, would have or would not have, you know, been locked up. But Joseph Doyle had a fairly reasonable way to approximate that, like, you know, the thing that you can't know, what would have happened in a different direction. And what he found, you know, he's a scientist, he's an economist, it's a pretty data heavy analysis. And what he found was that foster youth were three times more likely to end up incarcerated. And that sort of lodged in my mind, and this is going back many years. And then there were other reports saying that 59% of kids who age out of the foster system at 18, 59% will have experienced incarceration of some kind by the time they're 26. And that could be in juvie when they're still a foster kid. It could be a county jail when they age out at 18 and there's no support for them. So they're probably homeless. There's a high likelihood of homelessness. So maybe some cops pick you up and you're in the county jail, or there's a serious crime committed and you're going to do, you know, time in state prison. But 59%, this is the system that we spend $30 billion for every year. This is a national figure. $30 billion for foster care, and 59% of its alumni are ending up locked up. You know, the numbers for homelessness are also incredibly high. So I started thinking, like, wow, those are the outcomes? That's what we're getting? And this was no recent spike or, you know, trend only in the last 10 years or something. Like, this has been going on for decades, maybe a century. We've only had foster care for like 125 years in the sort of sense that we understand it today. We've had that system for a century or 125 years, and this has been the pattern all along. The overlap between foster care and lockup is so strong, and it's really, you know, people in the system know it well, but regular people out in the world do not know this, even though the effects of foster care are all around us every day, right? We're all paying with our taxes for, you know, the U.S. prison system. We're all paying through our taxes for social services for the homeless, and just general kind of the kid sitting next to your own kid in school. That kid could easily be a foster child who is not going home to a, you know, to the same kind of home that your kid is going to. That kid might need not even know where he's going that night, because social workers pull up at school with the kid's stuff in the back of their car and they're like, hey, get in, we're going somewhere else tonight. And the kid had no heads up, no idea. The effects of that kind of instability are profound, and they show up in behavior.
So sad, Claudia, because for me, again, siblings that have multiple brothers and sisters are sometimes split. And sometimes they wind up with caregivers who are probably not the best. They're really doing it for the business side of it. And I don't want to stigmatize that in any way, shape, or form. But for us, the Black and brown children who are stuck in this system, it's to no end. And you have an older sibling where we can't take the older one. We can take these two little ones. That split, going to schools where kids are asking, is that your real mom? Is that your real dad? Like, there is so much that's layered with this. And I'm really, you know, sad. And every time that I do hear these stories, because they deserve a chance. And why not? Is there a way to kind of fix the system, if you will?
Yeah, I don't know about fix the system. Sometimes people say, what are the solutions? And I'm, you know, there's no magic solution, right? But what we can do, or what we could conceivably do, is retool the system to better align with brain development. Like, when foster care started, we didn't know, right, how kids develop, what kids need to develop in a healthy way. But we do know now. And what we know, one thing we know, is how profoundly important attachment is. You know, for like an infant, attachment happens before you can even talk, right? Humans are wired to attach to their caregiver. So when foster kids, like an infant in foster care, is given to a foster parent, that baby attaches to that foster parent, the caregiver, right? And this is a neurological thing, chemical in the brain. This isn't like, oh, I feel attached to you. This is, I'm not talking about that. It's a neurological phenomenon where, you know, the human beings, for survival, right, you need to bond to your caregiver, because you can't even feed yourself when you're an infant, unlike, say, you know, a baby animal that pretty quickly can fend for itself in the wild. Humans can't do that. So humans need attachment for healthy development, for learning. We saw, all of us saw this during the pandemic. And I was talking with a school principal. This was an elementary school principal. We were just chatting, and she was telling me what a disaster it was going to be for kids for learning, because she was saying kids need connection to learn. They can't learn the same way when they're by themselves at home in their room looking at a screen, for those few kids who were actually doing it. It doesn't work. Humans actually need connection to develop in a healthy way, to learn, for all kinds of sort of basic operating systems of humans. So we could retool foster care to focus more on attachment and bonding. Right now, the structure of the system is such that it's built in. You're going to be moving on unless you're adopted. And adoption has many of its own problems that are also talked about in the book, Wards of the State. There are some efforts underway now, beginning to be. I mean, it's pretty late, right? We've been knowing about the problems for a long time. Finally, there are some efforts underway to at least address this importance of connection for kids. One of them is kinship care. which used to be, you know, forbidden, right? The idea was, oh, you come from a bad family, a problematic family. The healthy thing to do is sever that connection and you never know them again and they're out of your life and you'll go on to this, like, you know, perfect future, which is absurd. This is not how human beings operate. They have bonds. Kids are bonded to people, including people who hurt them or neglected them, including less than perfect parents. To ignore that isn't simply uncomfortable or unfortunate. It's actually counter to brain science. So kinship care is the practice, the relatively new emphasis on, if a child must be removed from their home, finding a relative, kin, who could take that kid. It could also be a family friend or a teacher or a coach, somebody the child knows, somebody that the kid has a connection with. So getting government support, money, for that relative or family friend, that is new. Because it used to be like grandma might take her grandchildren in, right? If her own child could no longer parent, but grandma was bankrupting her retirement savings to care for kids at age 75 that she never intended to be parenting, right? So what that was the case like in 2005 when I was beginning to write about this stuff. Now there are efforts and it's spotty, you know, state by state, but it is happening more and more. And there's support finally at the national level to license kin or relatives to take care of just their kid, their daughter's child, right? Rather than jumping through all the hoops that you need to jump through to become a licensed foster parent for any child. So that's one thing, kinship care. The other effort, which is called Quality Parenting Initiative, and it's happening in like 10 states, is similarly focused on encouraging and supporting connections between the kid and their caregiver and between caregivers. It used to be that foster parents and biological parents would never talk and they, you know, they weren't supposed to. The system didn't want them to. Some of that is not really great for kids. So some of that is being addressed through this Quality Parenting Initiative, which is really more on the foster parent end of things.
Really dope. I think that that's a start in the right direction, because I feel that that bonding that you lent to is really key. Having that attachment to at least a family member, someone you know or can trust. Shout out to all the people who, even teachers that I know, that have stepped out the box to add a child into their family set to make sure that they have a second chance. But again, just like you said, it is a systemic problem. It's not a fix. There are some solutions, but I think we're going in the right direction. Looking back to like New York, throwing out numbers here, like 7,000 to 8,000 are now the numbers for kids in foster care identified, where back in the days we were talking 40,000 to 50,000 kids were caught up in this system. So I believe that there are some moves that are going positive. However, there is still so much to be done. But I do like that restorative work that you can help support a young mother who kind of didn't know what she was doing and got into this because she didn't have support. And now she's ready. And now she's ready to, you know, get back to where her family is. And there is so much here. And really, thank you again for this work, because by, you know, shining light on this, you are giving every child that's out there struggling without a name, without a face, without a family, that opportunity. Let's get into your book, Wards of the State. Why is this book so important for you?
I want to tell your listeners that the book is really character driven. So the book follows six young people. Mm-hmm. They're all former foster kids, or they were in the system when I started talking with them. The point of the book is, in doing the reporting, I identified sort of four things that happen to kids in foster care, really normal things that happen to kids in foster care that seem tied to a likelihood of incarceration or homelessness after foster care. And they're really basic things. Running away. Huge numbers of kids run away from their placements, even just for a day or a week, a month, longer. Just running away. You're likely to get hungry when you're out there. You might shoplift or be trafficked. And the cops are going to pick you up and you're going to juvie. And there you go. You just got locked up, right? That's how an enormous number. That's why the numbers are so high. That's one reason. Broken adoptions. I mentioned adoption as well. There are a lot of kids. I didn't know this before I got into reporting this. And a lot of kids don't know it either. A lot of children are adopted from foster care, but they can be sent back. So that happened to two of the young people that I profile in this book. And so that's when the adoptive parent, after whatever, a month, 6 months, a year, 2 years, says, yeah, I can't deal with you, you know, no. And back to the system you go. My lead character, the opening character of the book, is this teenage girl, Marianne. This happened to her. She had no idea. She told me from prison. She said, I didn't know it was possible to be unadopted. I think a lot of kids don't know that. How are you going to know that? But it happens a lot more than we realize. It's something foster care does not talk about very much. And the effects of that kind of rejection. I mean, it's an absolute rejection. Yeah, we don't want you. Goodbye. It's not like a parent who is addicted to whatever and they can't help it because they have an addiction. This is a person consciously saying, yeah, we tried it. We don't like you anymore. No. The effect of that kind of rejection is profound. And again, it has profound ramifications for behavior. So that's the second thing: running, broken adoption, living in a group home, also very common. If you're not adopted and you're an adolescent, you know, 12 years or older, you're very likely to end up in a group home where fighting is endemic and kids assault staff and the cops come and there you go. You just got locked up again. Or aging out at 18 without any support, without any family support. So I found young people who could sort of illustrate each of these four aspects. Not every kid in this book ended up locked up. I think it's important to say, you know, one of them became an incredibly successful activist who has, you know, worked with three administrations in the White House. He's only like 33 years old, 35, you know, really young. But, you know, the youngest person in the book was 18 when she and I started working together. The oldest person is now 60, who got a life sentence very shortly after leaving foster care for a murder. And the point of the book is to sort of show these kids' paths and how they ended up where they ended up, what happened, while illustrating these sort of four aspects that lead almost straight to prison or lockup.
I mean, you're not even doing it justice. These are gripping stories that you put out here. Like Marianne, when I first got into this, I'm like, you're really underscoring what it looks like to be caught up in a situation where it's either life or death. You're running away from being trafficked. And now you some way, somehow defend yourself and you have to kill someone. Unfortunately, this experience really like underscores so much exposure to abuse, to neglect, to what it looks like to have a parent who's stuck on substance abuse to none, you know, to no fault of your own, but it also tells me about early childhood and how it really sets the stage for long-term psychological, I'm just not going to win, and these behavioral issues keep going. I also heard about systemic failures in here, about how that can compound trauma. Despite all the things that people can say and hotlines and come to this center, really sometimes that intervention comes way too late. And a lot of it really lacks the support and depth to fit the cases that you're really talking about here, because they have to be highlighted specifically for multiple things. Some of these kids are dealing with multiple types of abuse, and systems aren't really carved out to really support them the way that they really should. Not that they cannot, but it's really hard to adapt to some of the things that these kids are really dealing with. And really shout out to you on that. Tell us a little bit about the stories, if any gripped you the most without giving too much away, tell us a little bit about which story really moved you emotionally and was like, oh, Claudia, you in this bag right now.
There are a lot of them. You hit it. I mean, I think the stories are incredible of these kids. I got to say two things. First of all, for those listening who say, what about the victims, right? I mean, right. People have been hurt, right? Okay. So no matter what kind of twisted path any of these kids took, or no matter their choices, which we could question or debate, I got to say, every one of these young people, or even not so young, every one of these people talked to me about their experience in foster care because they wanted to make it better for the kids coming up behind them. Mm. And, you know, I find that sort of strangely, you know, very moving, but also kind of hopeful in some way, right? A lot of these kids are demonized, right? They have no empathy, they're sociopaths, like all the stuff, right? Everybody said it to me. But no, every one of them talked to me to make it better for some other kid that they don't know coming up behind them. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we demonize kids. It's not like that. In terms of stories that really got me, I want to say one thing that sort of ties to your previous point. Yes, it's true that a lot of intervention comes too late. However, anybody can make a difference. And it's not like, oh, if you missed, you know, if they're 5 years old, it's too late now, right? Like anybody can make a difference. There's a story in the book about this guy, Jay Perez Torres, New York City foster kid, walking around New York City with his stuff in a garbage bag for years, was living at group homes, was, you know, eventually became a gang member, right? This is like pretty entrenched in crime, homelessness, foster care as a teenager. Okay, on his fourth high school, he's only like, you know, like 17 years old. He's been to four high schools, right? But he meets this person whose job it is to help kids graduate. This is like a last chance high school in Manhattan. And this woman, she herself is practically a kid. She's only like 23 years old, right? It's her first job out of college. She barely knows what she's doing. She's not some seasoned professional. All she was I think it was called like a graduation advocate. Her job is just to figure out what is keeping this or that kid from graduating, from getting their diploma. It could even be like they don't have an alarm clock to wake up in the morning, or they have a job, or they're caring for a younger sibling, whatever it might be. Her job is to address that problem so the kid can graduate. So this guy, Jay Perez Torres, hasn't shown up in her office. She's been trying to reach him. She can't find him. He hasn't shown up. And she goes out into the halls looking for him, and she sees this huge dude covered in tattoos, kind of like skulking down the hall, clearly trying to not be seen. He's a huge guy. She's like, come on into my office. You're Jay. We got to do this. And she's just sort of taking down basic info for him. But it was one person who wanted to listen to him, and it just exploded out of him, all this stuff. And you know, all this, like what his life was. Trying to take different paths to school so that gang members from another set who didn't like him or wanted to hurt him, you know, he was constantly dodging other kids, trying to find different pathways to school. This woman, like I said, was only 23 years old. She was not experienced, and she was not some kind of like psych major or anything like that. All she was a person who would listen and try to help him on Google Maps, like find new, different routes to school. They worked together for like 9 months, not that long, not years and years. This kid graduated. He went to college, like the only person in his family ever, right? He went to college. I guess I'll just say it, spoiler, right? Like 2 weeks ago, I saw him earn his PhD.
Hmm.
Like incredible. Right. I just told you all the kids who don't even, you know, go to college or don't even get out of high school with a diploma. This kid actually went all the way. And it was really through the sort of basic attention, like nothing major, basic attention from one person who would regularly just sort of like, let me listen, let me help you out, let's figure out Google Maps and get you to school a different way. That was it. It was no big magic. She didn't even know what she was doing. She had no idea sort of the future that Jay went off into until I sort of reconnected with her and said, hey, that kid that you helped, well, he's working on his PhD. And I just emailed her today and said, yeah, he did it.
And
it's incredible.
That's like a proud mama moment for you, because you're like, man, I really got into this work to shed light on this, but to hear this, wow, that is just amazing. The other part for me, within your book, what are we going to get as readers about what the system can do when they fail us? And within your stories, it's not about failing us once, it's failing us again and again. So there's a side of resilience here. What is your book telling us about that?
About resilience? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. Kids who have been through foster care a lot of times have, you meet them as adults and you can still see it. There's kind of an armor, there's kind of an edge, right? And it's no surprise. These are people who have grown up, it's not safe to trust. Why would you trust? I'm not talking about abuse. I'm talking about nobody has shown that they're gonna care for you in an ongoing way, right? Like, so you, why would you believe anybody would? However, like I just said in that story about Jay, there's such a thirst, I think, to connect, that when a person, I'm not going to say it's like a magic miracle every time, but I am going to say there's more of an opening here for connection and resilience than we might think. We might think, oh man, it's too late, or they seem scary, or they're so reactive. I mean, one of the problems about growing up without secure attachment is how that shows up in sort of emotional reactivity. So the things that all of us, that every adult kind of deals with in life, like anger or impatience or boredom or humiliation at your job, right? We all have to deal with this stuff. A lot of kids who have been through foster care do not have the kind of emotional stores to kind of swallow it and move on, persevere anyway. That is really, really difficult. However, so there's like reactive, or they quit, you know, forget it, and they walk out of jobs all the time. However, there really is this thirst for connection. And if you can be there, and it doesn't have to be in a huge way, but just in a regular way, in a predictable way, in a stable, ongoing way. I mean, I saw it during this book. I worked on this book for 6 years. I'm in touch with all the kids in it. Not every day, I'm not like in every little bit of their lives, but you know, we text, we call. And I think it makes a difference. I'm not saying I'm saving any kid. I'm not trying to save this or that kid, but I can see behavior change. And I'm not the only thing in their life that's causing a behavior change. But I will say, there's a story about this first teenage girl in the book, Marianne. She killed a guy when she was 16. She was charged with murder. Because of an interesting newish law in Washington state, even though she was 20 years old now, she had been locked up, she was in prison, but the laws in Washington state changed, and they allowed for people who had been charged as adults for a crime that they committed when they were minors. This means they're charged as an adult because it's a really serious crime. Washington state decided it would allow some of those people to be in a youth facility until age 25. The law was called JR to 25, juvenile rehabilitation to 25. This girl, Marianne, had that experience. So she's 20 years old, and she goes to this, like, you know, youth lockup, juvie prison. The idea behind JR to 25 was all this brain science stuff about how brains are still developing and you can actually impact a kid's brain up into their mid-20s. So why would you put that kid in prison where that's what's going to impact their brain? Maybe put them in a youth facility where there's more education and counseling and all that. That was the concept behind the law. In truth, you know, when I saw that this was going to, you know, Marianne was going to have this chance, I thought, man, no way. There's no way some, you know, youth prison, government run, no way is it going to make a difference. This girl committed murder. She's going to need some serious, serious help. And this government system is not going to do it. Well, I don't want to give away too many spoilers here, but I will say I was partly right and I was partly wrong. And there was a big change in Marianne. And I will just say, I think a lot of that has to do with the same thing we were talking about before, stability and consistency.
I like
what happened, really. I'll just say what happened was not that this JR to 25 law was so great. The change that happened in Marianne is more of a reflection on foster care. Once she was in a place where she was going to have food, she wasn't worried about someone jumping her on the street. Like, she was safe and there was going to be a regular adult, her social worker, who was not going to change every month. It was going to be that person all the time. Massive change in her.
Mm. You know, I like that consistent environment, you know, is essential for this, you know, stability and this trust building, right? Because some of these youth who are caught up in foster care, they do face, especially like teen girls, like Marianne, they can be vulnerable to sex trafficking, exploitation, you know, some emotional needs that they may have that's untreated, lacking a stable adult. Mental health is limited here in many of these options, right? And even where you are, you know, teens can get caught up as young as 13 and they don't want counseling because they've been already systemized with their parents and now they're traumatized and these can fall through the cracks. So kids like her really get caught up into a situation that they don't really trust anyone. And they feel this sort of discomfort with affection because family was never really there. They didn't have that. So I do like that consistent, you know, consistent environment, if you will, can lend to that. And we heard it earlier when you shared about Jay, to have someone just being there to listen. It takes a village, but multiple people like yourself and social workers and DCF and other systems that can really step in will really be key to the future of some of these kids turning it around. Was there anything about your book that you feel like, man, 256 pages ain't do me enough. I needed to do more. I forgot this part. Is there anything there that you wanted to go back on?
Well, I think I'm good with that. However, the subtitle of the book is The Long Shadow of American Foster Care.
Mm-hmm.
So the shadow is, it's a shadow over the lives of the kids who are in the system, because it's not like you leave foster care and you're like, great, now it's all in the past. It's shaping all of their lives forever, including people who went on to great success, who became lawyers and activists. It's still shaping their lives. It is a shadow. It is also a shadow over our entire American culture, right? Like, foster care, I think, is an unacknowledged driver of homelessness, mass incarceration. So, right, it's a shadow over all of our lives, but it's sort of invisible. But I said American foster care in that subtitle. And so I am quite curious to know what happens in other countries. So you asked, like, what else is there to look at? That is one thing. There is in the book a sort of maybe solution that, or at least an attempt at something that comes from the UK, comes from Britain. And it's not working fantastically, though it does work for some kids. And it's a type of housing for kids who are runaway or homeless. But that is the only, this sort of import from the UK, that is the only real research I did on what other how it works in other countries, and I am now quite curious to know how it works in other countries.
It sounds like you're going to be writing a couple of more books, my friend. I oh, my God. Write some books. Who are you telling? My thing here is there's so much that goes into this work for you. And this book was no different. You've done tons of stuff. And actually, having to put this together, I'm sure the years that you put in, blood, sweat, and tears, how was this tugging at the heartstrings for you? How difficult was it for you to really put this piece together?
There were some rough moments. So, you know, I got the kids' files. And there's some pretty sad stuff in their child welfare files. And these files are thick, you know, like an inch. I mean, sorry, like a foot tall. I mean, these are fat. These are thousands of pages. I think Marianne's file was well over 2,000 pages. And so is this other girl, Monique, who's in Houston. The book is national for your listeners. It's kids all over the place. So Monique was in Houston. Her file was quite upsetting, super long, well over 2,000 pages, and really disturbing. There's another guy in the book. His name is Arthur Longworth. He's now, I mentioned him, he's 60 years old, and he had this life sentence very shortly after leaving foster care. Talking with Art really educated me about what it is to be a kid alone on the street. Art, and by the way, none of these kids were like crying to me or like, oh, feel sorry for me or any of that. Certainly not Art. Art was not, none of them were sort of begging for sympathy or anything like that. It's more about really matter of fact, this is my life. Art really helped me understand what it was like to be alone on the street and hungry. So when I would see other kids in Seattle on the street, because there are tons of them, it did help me to see them in a different way. And I think that was a good thing. It was a little, it was painful, but it was a good thing. Reading some of those case files, however, was, you know, pretty challenging. I mean, you said it before. I've been doing this for decades. I know this stuff. It's not going to surprise me, but you know, you don't leave it at the office, right? You take it home with you. It's in your head. I have a family. I have a son. He's a teenager. He's the same age Marianne was when she killed someone. You know, I look at him. I look at her. I you can't help it. You know, put sort of like, what if his life was different? What if Marianne had been my kid? You know, you think these things, right? Yeah, it comes into your life, but this is the job. I mean, this is the job.
Again, kudos to you, friend, for doing this work. You know, for me, as I'm listening to you, I'm also capturing that the resilience piece again, but also stories like Art's. You get to hear that they don't want you to feel sorry, but they also want you to learn from their experience as if they're paving the way. Here is someone who is listening to me. I want to tell you so that when you are out here, you can tell if there's a person struggling with this, this is what they may be thinking. This is what they may be dealing with. So I do appreciate that, even though that they have to take the fall, that they're willing to pay it forward and say, go out there and do something about it, because there are many people out here struggling with this. Tell me about the demographics. Probably not surprising, but what was some of the backgrounds and ethnicities for these kids that you mostly work with?
Sure. I want to say, just sort of riffing on what you just said, the idea of the book was to tell it through their eyes, like through their eyes. What is that experience? What does it feel like in your head, right? This is a very difficult thing to do because a kid can't really articulate what is it like for them, right? And a lot of people who come through foster care, like I said, have really spotty education. So they may not be able to articulate it really well. Art, what made Art so important to the book was Art is 60 years old, like I said, and he happens to be a really talented writer. But because of so long in prison, there's a certain kind of paralysis or frozen, like your development is in some way frozen. So that person is still really in touch with the with their experience as a teenager on the street, yet now he's older, so he has these tools to be able to articulate it, to explain it. That is why art was so important. So Art and Marianne are both white kids, and many people will know Washington State is, well, it's changing, but I mean, in terms of numbers, I think what you're asking for is, you know, what groups of kids are overrepresented in foster care. This is well known that African-American youth are wildly overrepresented in foster care. That doesn't mean that they're the numeric majority. They are not the majority. It means that like while Black kids are like 14% of the population of under 18-year-olds in the U.S., kids under 18, it's like 14% are Black, yet they're like, you know, well, like double that in foster care. In fact, I think I just had this, I just wrote this down. Yes, they're 14% of all U.S. kids and like 23%. That number, I think, is sort of debatable, but the official number is 23% of the kids in foster care. Then there's other stuff that like that could go into that number. So maybe it's a little higher than 23%. But like if they're only 14% of the youth population in the US, that means they are overrepresented in foster care because they are well beyond 14% of the kids in foster care. Jay Perez Torres is Latino. There's another girl in the book, Tina, also, she's Puerto Rican, was sleeping on the subways in New York City as a foster kid on the run. What I would say demographically, which is to me, at least as important as the racial ethnic breakdown, class. There are no middle-class kids in foster care, and there are no rich kids in foster care. There is no affluent kid in foster care, but there's certainly abuse and addiction going on in middle-class and affluent homes. Only poor kids are removed. All the kids in foster care come from poor families. That's the, I think, the real tell, right? We don't do this to middle-class kids.
Mm. You know, you in this piece was able to show us males, females, all the same. There's no real outlier there. But for me, as always, one is too many. And you named so many ways that we are impacted. Think about their opportunities, how they've been crumbled, and these kids have to find a way. Really impactful the way you told these stories. For me, I also would like to know the younger version of you, the one that went to report at school, now knowing all this game you know now, and you wrote this book, what would you tell that Claudia now?
Oh man, it's what I tell everyone. Look closer, look closer. We all recoil like instinctively from things that that frighten us, right? Or that we don't understand. People are like, ugh, right? I spend my career trying to look closer. There is a reason. Understand what's happening here. Try to get in that kid's head. I mean, I was trying when I was 25. I'm a lot older now, like a lot older. And I'm still look closer. Like I said, art, you know, I just learned this in the last couple of years from reporting and hearing Art, who's pretty close to my age. You know, he's 60 years old. I'm not 60, but I'm up there. And, you know, Art is, he didn't say, Claudia, look closer. But just from learning from him, I did see kids on the street in a different way. So I guess I would have told that younger Claudia, keep going. Don't be afraid. Look closer. Look closer. You can understand more.
Mm, well said. Before we let you go, friend, the floor is yours. What do you want to tell our listeners about you, the book, and the movement going forward?
This is what I want to say. Right now, finally, there is beginning to be kind of a a slow but broad recognition about foster care and how it's this invisible thing connected to so many other very visible problems in our society. One thing about foster care, because it involves minors and it's the government acting as their parent, the government says, oh, for confidentiality, for privacy, you can't really know what's going on with this kid. You're not going to be interviewing this kid. Privacy for a minor, right? What I found was that every person I wanted to talk to was dying to talk to me. They desperately wanted to tell their stories. So this shielding and this confidentiality that the government says is protecting kids' rights, what it's really protecting is the government. What it's really protecting is the system. It's very difficult to scrutinize or evaluate what is going on in foster care because nobody can talk to the kids except for the professionals in the system. No outside journalist, right? It's very, very difficult. That is a lot of the reason why I was talking to people who were recently out of the system. Also because they could articulate their experiences because they're a little bit older. So what I want to say is, while I appreciate the need to sort of protect kids, that thing about confidentiality or children's privacy sort of suggests that there is something to be ashamed of. Like, we're going to be secret about you're in foster care. Like, not people aren't supposed to know that. I don't really understand why that should be a secret or something to be ashamed of. I think the more people who have eyes on kids and the more that kids realize people want to help them, people want to see them, that helps everyone. So I'm somewhat frustrated by this sort of automatic shield, because I think what I found was that kids were dying to talk to me.
Meant to spill. You know, I'm very proud to have learned so much today about a topic that sometimes gets overlooked. People don't really say too much about it. And this goes out, shout out to all the kids out there fighting. A true fighter is not defined by the battles they win. It's about the falls, the fumbles, and their failures. We learned today from all of the people that you interviewed that lessons happen first and success could happen last. When one door closes, another one opens. Possible is everywhere. Never give up. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show. Coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Claudia, thank you so much for such an amazing conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved talking with you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just. He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa. Esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho. Thank you.